Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Friday edition of the Daily Friend podcast. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Gabriel Krauser.
Howdy, howdy.
And Sarah Gon.
Howdy, howdy, too.
So just a sort of note, we're going to be looking at not doing as many filmed versions of the Daily Friend. We're going to save those for special occasions. So we're going to continue with an audio-only version of the podcast on Fridays. Right, so let's start off with Minister of Finance, Tito Mboweni. He's delivered the budget recently, and the country's finances are in a very poor state. We're heading very quickly towards a 100% debt-to-GDP ratio, which is not a good thing at all. We've got 7% deficits. To alleviate this problem, many solutions have been proposed. In the case of Eskom, COSATU and the government are in talks about having pension monies used to prop up Eskom on some sort of promise that they'll be paid back eventually. The finance minister, Mboweni, has now said that it should not just be unions and government sector employees, but it should also be private pensions that should be used to prop up Eskom. In other words, prescribed assets. Gabriel, did we warn of this day?
Yes, we saw this coming. And I think we would have been in better stead if more people had heeded those warnings and joined us in sounding the alarm, looking at the dashboard, looking at the blinking red light and saying, we cannot keep going this way. We're going to overheat. I want to say a point before getting into that history about false equivalents. I think many listeners will have heard this phrase. The thought is that a problem comes before you and the primary school teacher says, well, every stick has two ends, every story has two sides, and any clash will involve two guilty parties, and so punishment must be meted out both ways. Personally, I remember suffering this when I was in grade 3 and I was kicked in the face, and I didn't even go to the teacher. Some other people went to the teacher, and she said, well, this is Newton's third law or whatever it is. Every action has a consequence. You must have done something to deserve this. And I thought, this is just a really odd way of going about
what a
evaluating the thing. Okay. But so what's the false equivalence? Cassata's position seems to be that we are in a position now where we have to tighten the bolt, where there has to be some reduction somewhere, some suffering somewhere. And it's very hard for them to see any kind of suffering outside of punitive suffering. So, you know, they think of it as there must be someone who must be punished. And so they think, well, okay, if you're going to punish the workers by retrenching some of them or freezing their wages, and they think it's a punishment just to have their wages increased by inflation rather than above inflation, as they've been consistently doing.
As they are used to.
Then someone else needs to be punished too. And it seems like, you know, the favorite targets are cabinet has to be punished. We have to reduce the size of cabinet. It's already been done. Reduce it some more. Directors general have to be reduced. Basically, the boards have to be reduced. But that's not enough. We also have to punish pensioners. So that idea is going to make sense if you live in a COSATU mindset in which there is no such thing as value add. Or if there is such a thing as value add, that's not a particularly interesting or important component in any evaluation, either economical or moral.
To quote Batman, Dark Knight Rises, it's not about what's right, it's about what's fair.
There we go. So, you know, here we are, we've got like 100 people at the table and we need to, you know, chip away at 10 happiness points from everyone. And then we've got an equal distribution of punishment or reduction or however you want to see it. That is one way to look at it. It's a worldview, and it's a very real worldview. There's another very real worldview, which is about value add, and pensioners are those people who have added value, who've been able to save, who've been able to store their savings in a way that continues to add value by being invested in productive activity, productive being another form for value add. And so they're the last people that you should punish. Now, I'm with COSATU. If they take Milton Friedman's line, there is no such thing as a free lunch. There is no way to dig ourselves out of this hole without using a spade. And that spade is going to have to move some sludge. I'm not with them if you want to say that the, you know, everyone's face has to be on the wrong end of that spade to equal measure. I think that what you've got to try to do is get the closest thing to a free lunch, which is to try and find those people who've been the most guilty when it comes to punishment and those people who are the most undeserving of the rewards that they're getting when it comes to basic reduction in benefits. And by every measure, that is the public service sector. Those are people working in the public sector. Eskom has almost doubled its staff in a decade that has seen practically zero increase in electricity capacity. That is prima facie evidence for overstaffing. That evidence has been looked into. Jabu Mabuza was the head of the Eskom board. He looked into it. He found that it was at least 33% overstaffed. And guess what? Pravin Gordhan didn't exactly have him removed in the sense that he fired him, but made the conditions for his sustained tenure impossible. And so now you've got an Eskom board that's much more friendly to not retrenching people. But it's not just Eskom, it's SAA, it's our rail network, it's all of the state-owned enterprises and those parts of the civil service that are not through SOEs, that are just directly from the government. So going after pensioners, I think, is something that makes sense if you think, well, suffering must come, you must distribute the suffering evenly. But it doesn't make sense if you think suffering must come, we must try and hone that suffering and direct it as with as great a focus as we can on those people that are getting wages without adding value that those wages, that meets the wages amount. So, okay, that's the basic, I don't know, you could call that a philosophical point, you could call it a moral point. In terms of seeing it coming, I look closely at statements by Ibrahim Patel and the ANC's convention at NASREC in 2017, and reading them together, it was pretty clear to me that the government was going after pensioners as kind of scapegoats or as a, you know, a great purse that you can tap into once all the other money has been stolen. Government pensions, let's say 2.2 trillion, pensions overall about 4.5 trillion. So there's a hell of a lot of money to be tapped into there. It's the last leg of liberty in South Africa. And knocking that leg out from underneath us is just sort of a perfect way to make sure that this country doesn't go anywhere for the next 50, 100 years. I noted that warning. I wrote a piece in Business Day. I wrote other pieces in The Daily Friend and other publications. I went and spoke about it on ENCA, on SABC, and I was hounded by big corporates, lawyers, people who are friendly to Patel and the government more generally, appeasers, and they said that this is crazy, this will never happen. This is not what they've said, and this is not going to happen. And one of the things that's frustrating about it is that, you know, there's this phrase, nip it in the bud. It really is easier to stop something when it hasn't yet gained momentum. In the winter of 2019, there wasn't real momentum behind the push to take pensioners' money. And there certainly was pushback, and the IRR was not alone in providing that pushback. Mike Schrisler is an economist who really has done a hell of a lot of good work on pensions and drawing attention to it. And you know, there was a good concerted effort to try and nip it in the bud. But by saying, no, don't worry about it, this is not going to happen, you're reading too much into it, when the ANC says it wants to investigate prescribed assets as a way, as, you know, one of the good lessons we can learn from apartheid as a way to prop the economy up, you should think of it as an investigation that's going to come to the proper conclusion that we shouldn't do this and no more than that. They effectively just bought time for the unions to rally behind this idea. And it's an idea that's hard for unions to sell because their members
are going to be affected by
have them, pensions. So they had to pitch it and basically a shroud of silence around the real drawbacks was erected so far as possible by those vested interests who are sort of committed to appeasing Ramaphosa at any cost. And that bought them the time to erect basically a political movement to push for this. And at this stage, has it gone so far that it can't be undone? In isolation, I think not. I mean, I think if this was the only crazy idea that was being put forward, we could stop it.
But at the same time, we've got NHI and EWC.
Yeah.
So we are facing a bit of an onslaught of terrible policy. And in our recent discussion that the IRR hosted between some senior economists, Lumkile Mundi, Magnus Haystack, and Davi Ruud, Davi said that the progress that we often see in a lot of countries is first you run out of taxpayers, then you run out of savers.
Yeah.
And then you start printing money.
Yeah.
So we do look a little bit like we're in phase two of that.
Exactly. And never forget that Ramaphosa, you know, Jesus, I've got a poster that I've kept in my office coming from the business day that said, Ramaphosa says don't touch SARS. I mean, don't touch SARB, the South African Reserve Bank, because that's phase three is the Reserve Bank to print money. But you read the statement that
he made.
He didn't say don't touch it. He said we're not going to do it now. We're going to save that for later.
We need to prepare our finances and make it correct first.
Yeah. So, I often think that if the president's inner circle was listening to our podcasts, they would agree with most of what we say because they also kind of see the phases. And one of the good things about Ramaphosa is he's really patient. He's not calling to print money before you've looted the pension pots.
Yeah, exactly.
There's 4.5 trillion that we're going to turn into nothing if we go print money now. First you take the pension pot, then you print the money. Yeah. This is a good proper socialist understand this.
Very good kicking the can down the road sort of thing, you know. We'll cross that bridge when we come to it.
There are probably three things that we need to say about this. The one is that the union's idea actually ended up being in a bit of retreat until it was brought back last week.
Yeah.
Because the essence of it's a defined benefit fund. Consequence of that is if they are not the funds at the given time, the government has to put in the money, which means we put in the money. So we pay for whatever it is. We're actually paying for it. They may as well just ask us for the money. The problem with private pension funds is that if we lose our private pension fund money, no one's paying us back.
Mm-hmm.
We lose it. Full stop. It's end of story. So obviously that just has no... And then just a third historical thing. When I started my legal career back in the day, one of the very big issues that we had to deal with in negotiations between trade unions and bosses was pension funds, because understandably unions and their members wanted that money immediately. And it was years of fighting to get them to appreciate that leaving that money and having a pension or provident fund available was necessary in the long term to protect them as they retired, as they got older. And that as a result of that very long protracted fight, we eventually got to the point where pension provident funds were understood and accepted.
Mm.
And this is like...
And well subscribed.
And this is like, I think people now really understand why they are so important. And now we're going to sort of kick that right under them.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one last thing about the pay-as-you-go and the defined benefit versus the defined contribution is we did have a substantial shift during the transition from the Nats to the Africanist Nats. as it turns out, didn't have to go that way. We had a big shift in how public pensions were managed to basically... Some economists will argue, and I think with some fairness, that the shifts that we made did reduce the overall investment capacity. But what we gained thereby was making things more transparent, because the basically the liabilities that the government has by making it defined benefit makes it very clear what is the government owe versus what the government doesn't owe. If you have defined contribution, then the government's liabilities become very fudgy. Yeah. And if you've got a government that you trust, then that can work well, and the fudginess is something that they can take advantage of to boost investment bang for buck. But if you have a government that can't do a land audit without cooking the books, that can't get half of its municipalities to get a clean audit.
Which is a point Lumkile Mondi made in that discussion group. He said, you know, this is the same government that can't really sort of manage anything.
Mm. Yeah, if you can't keep the lights on.
Or what was it exactly said? If you want my pension, no China. So, all right, let's move along quickly to... the country's most racist political party, the Black First Land,
which is really
that's stiff opposition, but they have managed to climb to the top of that tree. They are currently arguing, I believe, in court that electricity must be free, particularly for Black South Africans. And during this case, they threatened violence against a state prosecutor. Sara, why don't you tell us a bit about it?
Okay. The actual harassment, they might have done that as well too. But the actual harassment occurred when they were sitting in the public gallery in the trial, in the case that Out has taken against Dudu Mayeni.
Mm.
And Out has basically wants her to be declared delinquent, a delinquent director, because if she's declared a delinquent director, she has to get off the 21 boards that she's currently on and has to be making money out of. And what happened was that she was in the dock, so to speak, And there was a break. Now, she was under cross-examination by Aalto's lawyers. And when her attorney came to talk to her. Now, you don't do that during cross-examination. So the person must not have any communication with their legal team. And some gentleman whose name I can't find offhand, but from Black First Land First, came down and actually threatened them and called a white bitch and I think told one of her colleagues to go back to Holland. A person by the name of Harrison had to go back to Holland. But the really fearsome thing about this was in the court, in a break between proceedings, when everyone else was around but the judge.
Mm.
Very clever. And it's not literally a physical attack. It's a racial attack, and it's an attack against judicial process because there was absolutely nothing wrong with what she was doing. So that's where the
So was Arta's lawyer trying to say no, Mieni's and her lawyer can't interact right now.
Well, she's on,
so she,
she's
they were trying to intervene with that as per the rules.
Correct.
And then Black First Land First came in to run interference.
Yeah, and I mean they actually had to call security in, and the court now has to look at providing security. In what is, I mean, it probably speaks more to the character Duda Mieni than anyone else, that these guys are ready to
fly the flag for her.
So here's a question I have for both of you, and a bit of speculation. Why does so little seem to be done about Black First Land First? Because very often the things they do stray into criminal conduct. It goes beyond sort of free speech. There's threats of violence. There's threats of hate speech. There's
multiple called for illegal land invasions.
Calling for legal land invasions, really bordering on genocidal rhetoric sometimes.
Yeah.
Why is action not taken against them?
I think it's twofold. One is that in order to get them prosecuted for committing a crime, all of these are crimes, or most of these are crimes, a complaint has to be laid against them, unless the police witness it. They can then open a docket themselves. They never do, unless one of their own gets attacked, I think. But somebody has to lodge a criminal case. The problem is that if somebody opens a case, the question is, will the police process it properly, investigate it properly, et cetera, et cetera, because they are probably guilty of an absolute myriad of things. And the only way you deal with people breaking the law is to charge them for breaking the law and hopefully prosecute and convict them for breaking
the law. So I think that is part of it, the reluctance to come forward. I think, but of course, the Fridays Front Plus came forward, you know, several years after they'd registered as a party with a blacks-only membership clause in their constitution. Eventually, Fridays Front Plus came forward and said, this is against the constitution. But the timing was so odd that they ended up sort of being on the ballot, but then sort of being struck down afterwards. It was kind of weird. So people do need to come forward timelessly and challenge them.
I think, exactly, that's a good example. The system worked when someone actually did something.
Yeah, I think there is, it was a difficult process. I think that I really think that it's important to compare Black First Land First to the Nazis. They're not as well organized. I know that when you bring the Nazis up, then people think it's a silly pit hole.
I'd like to defend this point. So obviously a lot of people do make ridiculous comparisons between the Nazis and...
Yeah, Obama was compared to Hitler a hell of a lot by Fox News when I lived in America. It was crazy.
And now stupid. Trump is compared to Hitler crazy as well. So the point, though, is that I think the reason why that thing has such purchase is it's a very... It's like the quintessential story of the rise of authoritarian evil in a society. And it is applicable to republics all over the world.
Yeah.
It is a sort of sequence of events that can be mapped onto a lot of other situations where it happens. And so it is often appropriate to use it as an example.
Yeah, just like if you look at a young entrepreneur, you might say, I can see the ways in which this person is following a path that was laid out by Steve Jobs.
Exactly.
He did it with Apple computers. This person is doing it with
It's not exactly
brand.
The same, but there's a lot of crossover.
And you can see if steps A, B, and C were similar or the same, then maybe X, Y, and Z are going to be similar or the same.
And of course, in this specific example, we're talking about people who are literally racial national socialists.
Black First, Land First, Land or Death to All Whites. I mean, they're not hiding it under a bushel. Okay, but so here's something that's important about the Nazis that's easily overlooked. There was some reason for ordinary Germans to feel aggrieved in the Weimar Republic. The Versailles Treaty left something to be desired in blaming World War One exclusively on the Germans and making it a shame to be a German and saying that Germans are an inherently aggressive race who need to be deprived of guns because they can't manage themselves. There was also hyperinflation. There was huge economic catastrophe. So there were a lot of reasons for ordinary people to be pretty bleak. And a lot of what made the Nazis work was, you know, a lot of, by the way, Germany had very high marriage rates between Germans and Jews and so forth. So it's not like Germany was the most anti-Semitic society or the most anti-Jewish society in Europe at the time. Probably that badge of dishonor or shame goes to Russia or somewhere else. Mm. But they could say more easily than a lot of other countries, we can't possibly be oppressive or oppressors. Look at how poor we are. Mm. Look at how downtrodden we are. Look at what a tough time we've had. Look at how stigmatized we are. Because we are victims, we can't possibly be victimizers. So I think that there's this very silly idea, and you see it in a lot of the work done by the Human Resources, the HRC, what are they?
Human Rights Commission.
Human Rights Commission, and a lot of the arguments brought before the Equality Court are of the nature that a black person can't be vindictive, revanchist, oppressive, or racist because there are so many poor black people around and because so many black people have been stigmatized here and through history.
I think essentially so what
because we are victims, we can't be victimizers. And I think Black First, Land First rides that wave of because we speak for victims, we can't be victimizers. And I think they get away with it partly because of an ignorance to history that every fascist regime in history has been based on victimhood, on the thought mm-hmm. that we're victims and so we can't possibly be victimizers. And secondly, because of a willful reluctance to look at the reality of South Africa, in which half of net worth of million-dollar millionaires are almost certainly black, in which parliament, the judiciary, the police, the military, the president, the cabinet, in which there really are a lot of very, very powerful black people, where power is defined by the coordination of violence rather than some sort of unicorn in the sky idea about what skin color's superpowers gives you.
Okay, thank you for that. And I think we need to move on to our last item today, which is tomorrow is the final day for submissions on the draft expropriation without compensation, the amendment to the constitution that is going to go before parliament and be voted on, and has both the support of the EFF and the ANC as far as we know. So I think it's very important to get your signatures in. You can also submit a submission through us by endorsing our one by going to our website and clicking the link there. Sara, is this how can people help out?
Well, essentially, you know, it's an attack on the right to own property, the right to private property that is yours. It's a fundamental right of the Constitution. I think a lot of people have got that and appreciate it, but one actually has to do whatever one can, and that's the reason we've designed the representation for people to click onto, because it's not long, it's short, and it's singularly theirs to do, and it's easy to do. Mm. And it's just absolutely critical, because the government, what they've tried to do is pass it off as this is necessary for land reform. And all the government's doing is lying. It's not about land reform, because there are a million other ways to do land reform as effectively, provided you're effective.
It's not about providing
land. Yeah, this is necessary for land deformation.
Yeah.
It's not about basically giving land to black people, because the state will hold all of that land.
Absolutely.
It's not going to be given away in freehold title or title deeds. Gabriel, you've described this as dragging a steak knife across the Bill of Rights.
Yeah. So I think that thinking of property rights as human rights is something that a lot of people don't do, because it's not often how it's taught. I think that's misleading. I think that that mistake has partly been made by the right in America through much of the 20th century. There was a sense that property rights sort of come from God, and that it's particularly about the economy, and then civil rights are something else. And so if you look at the history of the civil rights movement in America in detail, you'll see this thought that civil rights are about racial discrimination. They're about where you can sit on the bus. They're about what kinds of schools you can go to and property rights or something else, and they're merely there to protect the rich. This was a rhetorical gambit played by a lot of racists to say that it's that property rights are not human rights, that they're something apart and that they're very important but can be isolated from this conversation. So that property rights must be absolute, but civil rights you can play around
but
with.
But of course they are in the Constitution alongside.
So they were portraying their own founding fathers in making that argument.
So perhaps Davy Ruart, who was on the same panel that Lucina Mondi was on, he put it best. He started off by saying, if you do not own, if you're not in a position to be entitled to own property, there is no economic activity. Nothing happens without being able to exchange property or money for property. Yeah.
So I want to say two things about the submissions process. One is that I was just reading a submission by one of the largest big business representatives in the country, and it's pretty close to the coalface of action in terms of the first likely targets of EWC. And you would expect from the headline to their submission and from how they've reposted in their newsletter that it's an outright opposition to expropriation without compensation. And so you might think that by signing onto that petition, you've done a good job of having your voice heard. But if you look at the details in the submission, they say things like, you know, the market system is a total failure. Market values are no good. You can actually never have a formula for calculating what kind of compensation should go to a property owner. So,
which is all rubbish.
So in other words, it's sort of like there's this fig leaf of being opposed to EWC, but the meat and bones of it, or the meat and potatoes, as Sitler likes to say of it, is really full of appeasement.
Yeah.
One of the reasons that you do well to sign up to the IRR's submission to Parliament is that it is unambiguous. It is clear not only about what the problem is right now,
but how to fix it.
Yeah. About how to fix the problem and how the problem would only metastasize a cancer throughout the body politic, especially amongst the most vulnerable South Africans, if we continue to go down the road that Cyril Ramaphosa has pledged us to go down to ever since he became president of the ANC at Nasrec in 2017.
All right. Yes. Thank you very much, Gabriel. Please go to our website. Click on the links there, support us, or SMS LAND to 32823. Become a friend of the Institute and support us with donations so we can keep this fight alive through whatever avenues we think are the best to oppose EWC. And hopefully we can maintain property rights in South Africa.
Yeah, and I just want to say one last thing. Property rights really are it's a in it together kind of thing.
Mm.
If you take away someone's property rights, you take away everyone's property rights.
Yeah,
just
exactly.
Like if you take away someone's due process rights, you take away everyone's due process rights.
Exactly.
Because anyone can then be the person who becomes the target of arbitrary expropriation.
Exactly.
So this really is about everyone, and we're stronger together. This means that there is no one that you know inside of South Africa that is not a pertinent sort of contributor to this. If you've already done it yourself, please reach out to others and ask them to do it. You have another 24 hours. It takes 2 minutes. Give it a go. And it's not the only thing the IRR does. It's not the only way to resist this encroachment on our human rights, but it is an important step to take.
Yeah, this matters to the poorest beggar and to the richest CEO. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you on the Monday edition of the Daily Friend podcast.